Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Objective. And today is a real American holiday and therefore a holiday to the whole world. Martin Luther King Day in remembrance of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights activist who stands out among the others in some respects. There were some civil rights leaders who were saying it's time to get violent. That's what some people were saying. There were some who maybe were like outspokenly Marxist and outspokenly looking to just like really revolutionize the political system of the US in the name of civil rights. And Martin Luther King was, we remember him mostly for his emphasis on nonviolence, I think. And although he had some, I think, philosophical flaws from our perspective here at the Ayn Rand Center UK. He was he was not an advocate of capitalism, much less laissez-faire capitalism. But we can definitely, at a more fundamental level, I think, appreciate some of the individualistic language that he used, such as in his famous I Have a Dream speech, where he said something along the lines of, I'll paraphrase, I have a dream that someday my black children can live alongside your white children and their Jewish children and be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. I think that's basically what he said, more or less. I think if he had said those exact words, the message would be basically what it was. And that's why I think we should remember Martin Luther King fondly. That is generally how we should look at historical figures. They're all flawed. In throughout history, at least most of them, and the vast majority of them were not philosophically consistent with what it is we believe here today. But why do we remember them? That's the question. We remember Columbus because he treated indigenous people a certain way. That's not what makes him stand out in history. What makes Columbus stand out in history is that he brought the Renaissance to a new continent, I think. And similarly with Martin Luther King, whatever flaws he may have had in his personal life or in his philosophy, I think the reason to remember him is that he stood up and spoke in individualistic language. But that type of language, sort of loosely phrased, is not enough to bring about a philosophical change in the culture or to leave a philosophical mark in any sustainable way. It needs to be more comprehensive. You need to have a full philosophy of individualism, which I think we have here. Before someone comments, oh, well, real individualism is impossible. It's impossible to be a perfect individualist. Nobody can do that. I will offer you that there is such a thing as perfect individualism in the context of reality, the individual having a very first-handed approach to the world, and then at a social level, having his rights be inalienable. And of course, that the political system reflecting that, which is what we are advocating for here at the ARCUK. So we need a philosophy. And because obviously Martin Luther King did not have a philosophy like objectivism that he was pushing, and because most of the culture does not share our philosophy here, it's become that Martin Luther King and other decent civil rights leaders were sort of latched onto by the collectivists, latched onto by the big government statists, and said, oh, you need to actually be pro-statist, you need to be pro-collectivist, and basically be a racist in the name of sort of fighting racism, a sort of ironic type of racism that we've seen emerge on the left. You need to be that, they say, or else you hate Martin Luther King, or else you're a Nazi, you're a racist. And we've seen it get worse with every year, with every decade. So what we need is a philosophy. It's great to hold on to Martin Luther King's individualistic language, but we also need a corresponding philosophy, I think. And that's what we're going to have. You like that confidence? Speaking of confident, we've got a guy here who, he's got this figured out. He knows no point in showing up at exactly starting time if the opening monologue ends 10 minutes in. Please welcome a guy who is right on time for all practical purposes, Dr. Reverend Dr. Mark Pellegrino.
Hey, Rocco, what's up? Sorry for my tardiness. I couldn't get on. Couldn't get on the show.
Well,
I just think it's because I'm technically not savvy, but
well, you know, technically you're savvy enough for this show. And yeah, so what do you think? I basically ran through the whole Martin Luther King, my perspective that generally we see him as very positive because of kind of what makes him stand out among the people in his time and certainly among civil rights leaders, his emphasis on nonviolence and his individualistic language in some of his famous addresses, or at least one famous address that he delivered.
I certainly think that makes him stand out above, head and shoulders above the current crop of civil rights activists and race baiters that we have out there today. There's a degree to which I think perhaps I'm not an expert in this topic by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel like the civil rights movement sort of had two possible directions to go in and it chose one. I feel like there was the Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington set that wanted to establish individual well-being. They thought that the political power would come after Blacks had individually established themselves economically and morally. The rest would sort of fall into place. And then there was the W.E.B. Du Bois and some of the other folks that came down the line from under his umbrella that felt political power was the ideal to reach. And then the rest would sort of follow. I think the civil rights movement went towards political power and not individual empowerment. And as a result, we see an intense Black political class that institutes collectivist ideas and profits from it themselves, but does very little for the Black underclass and the working class Black man who is looking and striving for the very same things that you and I are looking and striving for. I think Frederick Douglass famously said, and I paraphrase, he didn't want help from people. He just wanted to be left alone to be able to achieve what he could achieve. He didn't want any hands up, hands out. He just wanted the freedom to be. And certainly the establishment civil rights movement has rejected that individualist take on things and embraced the other. And Martin Luther King was sort of a hybrid to me. I mean, he said some very great things about individual character. He was trying to make race the non-essential thing that it is. But by the same token, he had, possibly because of his Christian faith, very socialist ideas that embraced this scary territory that enabled the civil rights establishment to take it, the movement in the directions that it's taken it in. But that aside, I mean, I think this article is just heinous. This article that Razi sent me is beyond awful on so many different levels. I mean, I think we should pick apart that doggone thing. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, as I reached the end of my monologue, I said, okay, well, yeah, I've covered Martin Luther King, but we're actually here not only to discuss that, but this article by Washington Post, which is titled "To Understand Trump's Support, We Must Think in Terms of Multiracial Whiteness." And if you read the article, I think you'll agree that what they're saying is whiteness is basically Western chauvinism. So the fact that we consider certain things beautiful is sort of a Eurocentric indoctrination that everyone, including Blacks and Latinos, have been sort of inculcated with. And that's the sort of standards of beauty. Also, the embrace of capitalism, they sort of marry to Western chauvinism. So if you're pro-capitalism, you're basically a pro-white, which sounds pretty racist. So there's a package deal galore in this article. I think package dealing is the ultimate fallacy that you can find everywhere. Once you understand the package deal fallacy, you can't unsee it. It just starts to show up everywhere. So they say white when they, I think, often mean capitalist, or even at times maybe nationalist. Now I'm opposed to nationalism as it's being pushed today. The only purpose of the nation is to secure the rights of the individual. And the only reason to celebrate the nation state is because of said protections of the rights of the individual. But definitely there's like a type of nationalism now that the author of this article, I think, is marrying to whiteness. And I say, yeah, if you want to link nationalism to whiteness, I mean, there's a bit of a fallacy there, but it's not my problem, because they're both, you know, none of those things are concepts worth fighting to defend. To me, it's individualism in its truest sense. That's worth fighting to defend. That's worth understanding and defending. So let's separate individualism from whiteness. I think that intellectuals have tried to say individualism is code word for white supremacy. And that is a hill to die on. I'm not going to let them have it. Will you?
Well, good. Well, good. I mean, I think nationalism too is multi-ethnic. I think there's been plenty of movements across the globe that are not white, that are about the establishment of indigenous people, and nationalism is meaning establishing the indigenous people as a political force. And the rallying cry behind that is the throwing off of, what is the throwing off of imperialism, but the establishment of one particular national identity over another. So it's not like white European males are the only folks afflicted with this concept of nationalism, which in itself just means sort of state sovereignty and a people's sovereignty loosely. I mean, it's come to mean many other authoritarian things as well, but every people across the globe has this sort of drive towards national sovereignty, you know, regardless of what that represents. So it's not something solely owned by white folks. But the particulars of the article especially bothered me. I get the sense that people like this disown aspects of themselves. And because those things, those psychological characteristics, because they've disowned those psychological characteristics, and don't integrate them, they see them out in the world, even though it's their own psychological characteristics they're actually attacking. Like one of the things that they pinned on whiteness was conspiracy theories. And I'm assuming this person is a left-wing person, but I think some of the biggest conspiracy theories out there were the Russian collusion conspiracy theory and the conspiracy theory that all police officers are hunting blacks down and trying to kill them in a concerted, organized effort to destroy the black community. These are conspiracy theories that captured the nation, that cost 30 lives and $2 billion in property damage and drained the coffers of the American citizens to the tune of $40 or $50 million investigating phantoms. And there's just one fallacy after another written in this article. It's offensive. It's offensive not because I'm a white guy and the person is claiming that there's such a thing as a political identity that's white, that's embodied in whiteness, and that can spread to other identities, ethnic identities, like a virus. But because it's based on, there's so much air in there. There's so much nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now let me steel man the left a little bit, because I think their perspective has been, and you saw them promoting this, especially in the aftermath of the George Floyd killing. Each of us has some latent racism, the perspective goes, because, you know, you could go around saying, I'm an individualist, I believe in the American dream, and that's great, but there's racism happening and it's not really your problem, you've been conditioned. I think that's a big part of their perspective. We've been conditioned. So when you were born, you were assigned a certain identity. So you were assigned a male, presumably, you know, straight. I don't know your personal life, but back to the topic at hand, straight, white, male, whatever. Maybe if you were born with money in a wealthy family or something like that, you were assigned a certain identity, and that shaped how you see the world. And today, basically, we've got 8 billion people walking around, certainly a couple billion in the developed world walking around with certain inherent sort of inescapable racisms, racist prejudices, including Blacks, including women, including trans people. Everyone has this. So nobody's absolved of this, but if you were in
Yes, people are absolved of it. There's only one group of people that are not absolved from it.
Well, I think you're on the right track, but in fact, even Black, like a Black straight guy, needs to sort of apologize to the trans lesbian woman, right? So like there is sort of a web of oppression, a sort of a complex system of intersectional oppression that the way that they're seeing it. So in the aftermath of the George Floyd killing, you had like basically everyone saying, it's not necessarily even that the cops know what they're doing. It's that the cop in his own inner world is just racist and he doesn't realize he's racist. And then his subconscious is just,
But that's undisprovable. I mean, it's an undisprovable premise. So it can't stand anything respecting a logical methodology to say whether or not this is so. And that's sort of the convenience of it. But look, I mean, yes, to a degree, these ideas that are now becoming dominant in our culture are based on a certain degree of truth. But there are aspects of our culture that shape us to a degree, that mold our perspective to a degree. And there is the fact that when you don't know somebody at all, there is a form of discrimination that you use based on not knowing. And that is a sort of, a form of statistical awareness, a form of maybe even a stereotyping of people that every single human being does. It's a form of quick categorization that could be blown out of the water the second you know the person personally. But Blacks and whites and every human being has that, for lack of a better term, categorization capability. That doesn't mean people are inherently racist. It means that people have to discriminate. They have to use their minds to discriminate, to differentiate all the time. And sometimes they do it with more information and sometimes they do it with less information. And sometimes those who think less are acculturated a little bit more. And sometimes those generalizations inform their choices more. So there's a degree. I'm not saying that the animus behind these movements is entirely false. What gives them purchase is the fact that there's a grain of truth. Yes, people are prejudiced, but they do exonerate. I mean, they do exonerate to a large degree people of color from, not from prejudice necessarily, but from racism, which they make a distinction between prejudice and racism. You know, if you're on the top of that oppression hierarchy, then you can't escape. You can't, because of your power dynamics, no matter what you think or believe, you can't escape the fact that you are participating in some oppression scheme, even if that's not the way you think. And what's that if not a form of racism and prejudice that they're exonerating themselves from?
And I think this shows the importance of philosophy and of kind of like defining terms and understanding what they mean in reality. So just like when Christians say we're all born evil, you know, we're all just originally sinful and we're all evil, then evil doesn't even mean anything anymore if there's no choice, right? So any moral judgment needs to come with a choice that somebody made. Now, I think the opportunity that the postmodern left or whatever this today's leftists are, what the opportunity they offer people is, if you just admit it, you admit that you have this, that you are a racist, and then you offer to be an ally and you play by the rules and you do what you're told and you don't do what you're told not to do, then you can be part of the solution. And, you know, don't expect don't expect the red carpet rolled out for you, but definitely you might not be, you might not be called like the worst person on earth. So they do offer an opportunity to get with the program And
it provided you a base yourself. The very thing that the author of the article said white culture is based on, which is abasement and power dynamics, is the very thing that's their solution. It's just changing out the players, but it's still the same power dynamics. It's just that now you're on the bottom and you're going to stay there because you deserve it. I'm sorry, I'm not going to abase myself to anybody. I don't deserve it. I didn't earn it. And so I'm not going to accept it.
Well, they would say you're using a lot of white terminology, talking about earned and didn't earn and denote who earned anything. You were born genetics.
Right.
I don't have your genetics. Why don't I have your,
going to insulate themselves in undisprovable ideas, and they're going to use language as a weapon to insulate themselves. And there's no arguing with a person like that.
I mean, arguing is for white people. It's more logic is whiteness.
Right. See, but reality tells us that logic is the bridge between human beings. It's the way that we understand the world and each other. And it's the way that we keep from being at each other's throats, right? Non-contradictory identification is the way we find the truth. Now you can claim that is a social construct, but you do so at your own risk. You can claim gravity as a white social construct, jump off a building and see how that works for you.
I just might do that. If these guys don't stop with their rhetoric, am I right, guys? I'm going to paraphrase Ayn Rand from her Philosophy Who Needs It lecture/essay, where I think she says something like, my goal today is not to sell you my philosophy, but to sell you philosophy as such. And I'm confident that if you go with it, you'll find my philosophy to be the best. Something like that is what she said. And I hope the audience is seeing with greater clarity the importance of philosophy. We need to understand what these terms mean, and also understand, if politics are your concern, that philosophy has a grip on politics and it shapes politics. You know, I saw the libertarian guy, I forget his name. Is it Justin? Justin Amash is his name. He's the one running for this, running for that. He's saying, I'm a classical liberal. He's saying a classical liberal is we're reclaiming the term liberal. And my response is, you know, what people call themselves classical liberals today, they're basically saying like, I'm a 1920s progressive in terms of the policy that they're for. And the actual classical liberal, I mean, bookmark that at least for a moment, but the actual classical liberals, the founding fathers, the Age of Reason liberals, they had a much more individualistic philosophy in terms of their, like you read someone like Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, they had a much more individualistically empowered view of what can be known by the individual and then the rights of the individual in politics, how they should be protected in the political sphere. So unless we have that, or Ayn Rand's sort of take on that, which is kind of a more perfected view of the individual in philosophy, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to have that in politics in any sustainable way. And when we see people in prominent newspapers like the Washington Post using words like whiteness and this and that and racism so loosely, or in their way of using those terms, it's hard to imagine that the political sphere is not going to be reflecting that increasingly in the future, and because it already has been and may get even worse. And the sort of backlash against that, the sort of reaction to that might be a form of biological determinism, kind of saying like, oh, it's not that, throw all that postmodernist crap in the trash. Everybody knows we're just determined by our biology. It's not about nurture. It's about nature. And then now these guys are the sort of so-called race realists pushing back against the postmodernists, and they could bring us a political reality that's even maybe even worse or just as bad as what the left is pushing for. So philosophy is kind of where the battle is going to be waged and hopefully won.
Agreed.
All right.
I have a hard out, Rutte. I have a business call. I have to be on at 10:30. So.
All right. Well, technically we're only supposed to be a 20-minute show. So let's exercise that here now, 25 minutes in. Thank you, Mark. Everyone stick around at 7 p.m. UK time and 2 p.m. Eastern on this very channel, the Ayn Rand Center UK. It's going to be The Impact of Atlas Shrugged, a panel discussion with Dr. Shoshana Milgram, Dr. Ellen Kenner and Dr. Andrew Bernstein. A lot of doctors, none of them have Reverend in their title. I don't know. I don't know if I should take them as seriously, but I actually think Andrew Bernstein would make a fine Reverend. So let's see if we can make that a reality. Thank you to the super chatters and to everyone else who watched and participated. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the Daily Objective. Thank you and goodbye.